Lecture 4, Kant and the Romantic Reaction.
In our journey together to see how some philosophers have understood the quest for the meaning of life, we've just looked at a very rational account. That's Kant's account. And I should say right now that if it makes perfect sense to you and Kant's account fits together and seems perfectly rational, and you're even driven to accept it or take it very seriously and want to believe it, perhaps I didn't give the kind of lecture I should. Because after Kant, countless philosophers take issue with Kant, and they do not believe that what he says or all parts of it add up. At the same time, we've seen in Kant glimpses of some kind of a mystery. Kant uses the word imagination. Maybe it wasn't the right label for an underlying energy that is part of our nature, that's beneath our reason. But we have glimpsed in Kant the elements of a mystery that perhaps we can't quite reach rationally. One thing is sure, Kant's account of reason is very austere. It motivates his account of the moral life. He even accounts for religion in this very rational way. Now, there are very strong reactions to this, and one of them is referred to as romanticism. And that romanticism thinks that it is too rational, too austere and confining, this Kantian notion. And they think that the strict adherence to a rigid moral conception of life crimps us, and that it leaves us with certain dilemmas. It leaves us with dilemmas that we have to look into. Let us consider. On the one hand, there's the unknown. We can't know the true nature of reality. We can't know our inner nature in its ultimate being. We can't know how the external world is in itself, only the ways that science can grasp it. And at the same time, there are things shrouded from us. There are things that are beneath our rational capacity to grasp them. One, which is beyond us, Kant construes as the noumenal world. What does Kant mean by a noumenal world? Well, he says we can only interpret, so we couldn't know by our reason what this noumenal world is like. Kant says whatever this noumenal world is like, perhaps God, if there's a God, could know that noumenal world, could know that noumenal world simply by thinking it. But Kant also says, and let's consider this further, that our human way of encountering things is by means of our senses. And if there's a noumenal world, that noumenal world might be the kind of reality that's beyond what our senses can tell us. Well, then, where are we? Problems are made even more difficult because of something called nominalism. Kant is an inheritor of nominalism. Nominalism is the view that each and everything, whether a noumenal something that may be beyond our senses, or any particular thing, is an individual. It's not a type. But Kant claims that we can only know by means of categories. Whatever we encounter, we can't know what we encounter in its specific individuality. We can only know it by means of the categories that we have at our disposal. And therefore, in that sense, our reason is also limited. And Kant further claims that we have intimations. Let's consider this a little bit further. Intimations of a world beyond this one that might altogether escape our senses. But he also says that we are sense-bound. We can only know what we encounter, and what we encounter, we can only know by means of our senses and what they can interpret. And there may be things that fall outside of the net of our senses. Kant's a great believer in science. Science structures our experience, and it tells us about the appearance of things, but it doesn't give us the reality behind the appearance of things. The reality behind the appearance of things remains shrouded in mystery. Well, what would you do then? Where would we go from here? One view is called fideism. Fideism suggests that maybe there could be a leap of faith regarding the nature of reality. Whether there's a noumenal reality that's beyond our senses or not, whether there's an ultimate reality that reason can or couldn't get, perhaps a great leap of faith might draw us to that. But Kant doesn't allow that. Kant doesn't allow such a leap of faith because all faith must grow out of reason. It must be rational. It must be a moral faith that's structured rationally. And only then would we be led to perhaps a religion. As we saw in our last lecture, Kant's notion of the journey of life involves duties and inclinations. And if there's a journey to life, it is meant to be the victory of duty, duty, duty over inclination. But think about it. Let's think about our lives. Aren't our lives a lot more than just duty and inclination? Don't we have a great bunch of desires, feelings, emotions? Kant inclines to call everything that isn't rational moral duty a cancer of human reason. He tends to talk as if that dimension of our life that isn't purely rational is in some way cancerous and to be overcome, that insofar as we don't act out of rational duty, we have somehow failed. A late 18th, early 19th century philosopher, Johann Fichte, following in the course of Kant, thinks that perhaps we should view this world as a moral testing ground, a place where we learn how always to act in accordance with duty, never in accordance with inclination. And if we understand why we are in this world, we are in this world to perfect ourselves, and Fichte would say, and the world is there as a battleground, battleground through which we would reach moral perfection. But Kant says some odd other things as well. Kant says that sometimes our imagination, now again, that mysterious force, fuses and wells up and connects with our reason and understanding. And when it does that, we have some experience of sublimity. We have some experience of something we can't articulate that elevates us, that we do not experience as thoroughly rational, that we can't fully comprehend, and that in some way in the face of everything Kant and even Fichte say about duty, that sense of sublimity, at least in Kant, gives us a kind of sense of transcendence. Kant also talks about autonomy. Autonomy as always acting as your own person, never in the kind of prison of what your desires are tugging at you to do. And when the Romantics hear about this notion of autonomy, always asking and asking and asking and working in terms of moral categories and not understanding life in terms of desires, they in fact are outraged by that. They are outraged by the notion that feeling, emotion, and desire aren't allowed to carry any day. And similarly, they're very caught up in the notion that there are sublime experiences possible. We get glimpses of something that's beyond what our reason and our sense of duty can ever give to us. And so out of that, Romanticism begins to arise. Glimpsing at Kant's notion of possible sublimity, glimpsing also at Kant's notion that when you come down to it, there's autonomy, but to the Romantics, that the fact that there's autonomy means maybe we are pulling ourselves back and not embracing our full being. Kant has one other thing to say before we move now beyond him. There's a strange notion. It is picked up by later philosophers. It's controversial to some extent, the degree to which it fully is in Kant. It is the notion of the phenomenon as some basic underlying phenomenon in our experience, a phenomenon that is within us. Perhaps it's connected with our will. Perhaps it's connected with our imagination. But whatever it's connected with, Kant sometimes talks as if, in the midst of all his rationalism, there may just be a way that we can come into touch within ourselves to a kind of ultimate reality. So there, Kant has opened a door, but he has not allowed even himself through it. He has talked about imagination and sublimity, and he talks about autonomy and the victory of duty over inclination in a way that enrages and causes reaction in this group of philosophers that we call Romantics. What Romanticism arises out of is the intense desire to experience the unity of personhood, to transcend dichotomies, both in ourselves and in others, and to come into some kind of direct contact with reality itself, something that might be masked by the worlds of ordinary experience and science. Some kind of fusion is sought. The Romantics have the underlying idea that we separate ourselves out too much, that too much of our experience does not have a kind of fusion and focus to it. And these same Romantics who believe that, believe that what we need is to look toward the creative, the artistic, the aesthetic. That is taken as the paradigm, as something that Kant almost opened the door to with this notion of the sublime or the imagination, but didn't let us through. And if we could just be more attuned to the aesthetic, that would give us the sense of unity, of unification, and belonging. It's part of the Romantic idea that we long for a belonging, a place that we can find to be home, and that is an underlying thing we want. And for the Romantics, the reliance on reason is too austere, and it doesn't give us that full, significant sense of being one with ourselves and having a sense that we are at home with ourselves and at home with and in the world. They're desperately concerned, the Romantics are, to find some way to get beyond the opposition between mechanism and teleology, the notion that the world could be viewed as a big machine, and yet the intimation we always have that there's some kind of purpose, some kind of sense of direction to the world, even if science often looks at it as a machine. Also, these same Romantics are concerned about the division of a person into separate and warring components. Reason and desire, public and private self, reason and passion, your will fighting your emotions. What the Romantics hope for is some fused and fusing experience that will give us a sense of oneness, a sense of connection with some kind of a whole. And they also look in a very problematic way at the religious. They wonder if there might be some kind of religious experience, clearly for them, not institutional, not formal and doctrinal, but some kind of experience beyond general belief systems that could somehow make us whole and give us a sense of fusion with something beyond, a wholeness that would make us feel at home, that the journey of life brought us to the proper belonging, and that our longing for a belonging would be taken care of. Two philosophers, Johann Fichte, who I just mentioned, and Johann Herder, who I mention now, pick up in certain ways on some of these romantic notions. Take the case of Fichte. You get the notion of the unity of a people. Now, this isn't even just the notion of an individual. In Fichte, it's the notion that in some way a nation can almost be a person. It's a strong voluntaristic notion that there are particular people. This goes against cosmopolitan understandings or the universalist conception the Enlightenment has that fundamentally we're all the same. Fichte picks up on the notion that there are different kinds of people, nations, for example, and that they have special traits. And Herder, Johann Herder, who lived like Fichte did at the end of the 18th century, also thought that cultures differed. That is, there are differing cultures, and how you are enmeshed or embedded in a particular culture, that may go way beyond rational conceptions. That may go way beyond a kind of uniformity. That in the depths of a particular national tradition, with its language and its culture, may very, very well be found a way to fuse with oneself, with other people, and with a larger world that reason maybe only dissects, reason maybe only categorizes. Very much part of what we've been talking about in these romantic motifs, this notion of the journey of life as a longing for a belonging, a longing to be one with oneself, a longing to fuse with something beyond, very much part of that is a kind of expressionistic understanding of the self. And out of that, a special emphasis is given to language. Expression is believed to offer the means of coming to the underlying unity with oneself. To find out who you really are, you must find a way to express yourself. And if you express yourself and find the right way to do it, you will come to be who you truly are. Now, there's an agony to this notion. There's an agony to this romantic tradition. And it's the agony that it may be a great and noble idea, but in some ways, perhaps it fails. It fails to establish a deep unity within the individual. We have to look for a moment at whether there is this kind of failure. If Kant was too rational, and the reaction was to find the wholeness of the person and to find a way of a belonging that went beyond rational distinctions, what about this romantic reaction? Well, it attempted to convey ideas and ideals through artistic and non-rational means alone. Let me pause for a moment about this, because the next reflection is one we will want to stay with. It will keep coming up in our time together. What we get out of the Romantics is the notion of the outsider. The outsider comes to be viewed as the paradigm of the individual. This outsider was construed as someone who did not usually connect with the normal, ordinary world. People who are not outsiders, insiders, are viewed as getting reassurance, support. They are viewed as getting security through their connections with other people. Yes, as I told you, Fichte did say that it's the nation that mattered, and Herder did say that it was a culture and a language that mattered, but the underlying drama and drive of the Romantics was the notion that there would be individuals. They would be outsiders. And as outsiders, without the support, the security, the reassurance of community and society, these outsiders would be vulnerable. And their very vulnerability might make them more in touch with realities that reason wouldn't reach. And it might open them up to a kind of creativity that they might not otherwise have. Kant was concerned with a scientific community of investigation. He had a rational faith and a moral life. The Romantics tend to be much more concerned about individuals. Yes, language, yes, culture, yes, nations, but really individuals. Vulnerable individuals who, as outsiders, do not connect. Do not connect in a way that offers reassurance. And that failure to connect opens them and makes them vulnerable. Vulnerable in a way that makes them touch more closely to themselves and perhaps releases a creative power. Well, what becomes fundamental is a concern for the distinction between the quality then of life and the quantity of life for these Romantics. It is not how long you live, it's the quality of your life. Whether that life can be a creative one, whether you can allow yourself vulnerability. Yes, there may be reason, but perhaps reason doesn't get deep enough into who we truly are. And perhaps reason in all its rationality can't reach far enough beyond into the ultimate nature of things. And if Kant's right that reason can't do that, so be it. Maybe the vulnerable individual outsider, the person who has had this glimmer of the sublime, this experience of the creative, maybe it's that individual that can do this. These same Romantics are very, very concerned and have quandaries about what our rights are. There's a lot of talk about rights. Now, should you construe rights as political rights? Many of the Romantics thought that you should have the right to overthrow the way things are if it is discriminatory, stale, conventional, restrictive of creative powers. Many of these Romantics thought you should have the right to form small communities and be left alone to do as you would do. But at the same time, these same Romantics thought that there was another sense of right. We could almost call it a psychological sense of right. Whether community or not, whether the right to change the world if it doesn't speak to the human heart, there was also this notion that you could only have an inner integrity. You could only truly be an individual if you were left alone to be an individual. And the right not to be interfered with came to be construed as a very important right for these same Romantics. They rejected what we would call realism. They saw it as too hard-headed. It is trying to quantify the agonies of the heart. It was too much concerned with calculation, with external success, with worldly power. The Romantics thought that the conventional world, however successful in ordinary terms it could make you, was a world which nonetheless could erode your potential, could gradually bring into your life a staleness. Now, some of these core values of Romanticism, stress on the individual, stress on the notion of the creative and the imaginative, they linger long after Romanticism. Now, frankly, often we review these Romantic values as adolescent. We actually do. It is a fact that we often say that these Romantic tendencies are fine if you're young, but as you grow up, as you become mature, you have to abandon them. You have to become more rational. You have to become more practical. But the Romantic idea is becoming practical, becoming more conventional, even in worldly terms successful, might be at the cost of your inner integrity. It might be at the cost of your potential creativity. And that if it is so in the extreme Romantic position, it is better not to succeed in a worldly sense if through the Romantic life of coming to find a way to express yourself and become one with yourself, if through that route you can have some inner sense of integrity. These romantics do not have an Enlightenment notion of a universal community. They tend to stress the notion of the lonely wanderer, who emerges then as the successor to what I've called so far the otherworldly directed axial pilgrim. Let's pause here for a moment. Think about this. The axial model that we've looked at is life would be a journey, and a journey from here to an elsewhere. And the elsewhere would be the place of our true belonging. And the journey then would liberate us. And it might even be an historical journey. But whatever kind of journey, we'd go from where we are to an elsewhere where we would belong, where we would find a home. And we've seen that for Kant, that might be reached rationally, even in the face of Kant's restriction of reason. But what you get with the Romantics is that maybe you have a home deep within you in terms of your creative abilities, but perhaps you will always have to be a wanderer, maybe always a lonely wanderer. Maybe, though you're in, you're not of this world, and your true home will never be found. That, however creative, however much you go against convention, you may always wander. And therefore, there may be, in the face of the quest for creativity, no final home that would be found. Conflicted reactions emerge regarding communities and the cosmopolitan in these romantics. They are very, very concerned that if we become more and more like each other, we may communicate better, but at the same time, we will become, unfortunately, more uniform, more like each other. And they're very concerned that we do not get trapped by sophistication, that we not get trapped by the notion that a great deal of knowledge of various parts of the world and a great education that knows many things, they're concerned that that might take us away from the very simplicity of the inner life. And if we're taken away from that simplicity of the inner life, have we perhaps lost our own souls? So as you can see, these romantics themselves are conflicted. They know that reason has limitations. They know that there's something wrong with a life in which duty is put against desire. They know there's something wrong with a life where we have to put on a public face and our private world is somehow something that can't be unified with our public being. They have a sense sometimes that maybe beyond urbanization, beyond industrialization, beyond organization and beyond bureaucracy, there may be something that one could connect with. But their journey seems to them agonizing, at times futile. But they have this sense that we have to have the integrity, we have to accept the challenge of trying to find that inner self, and that perhaps if we find more ways to express ourselves, more ways to find an authenticity that may require that we pull back from the world, the better chance we have to find our souls and perhaps even to heal our souls. So we have two problems, don't we? We have a rationalism in Kant that seems limited. And if that is the journey of life, doesn't it seem austere? But what about the romantics? They say so many different things, things that seem to offer hope, creativity, imagination, pulling back from the crowd. But at the same time, we don't know how to make those things fit together. Now, if you'll think about it, as we're taking our journey together, we have said very little about history. Kant has a view that says little about historical development. We just affirm reason. The Romantics are concerned, what, to rebel, to step back, to get beyond or beneath reason, but never with a sense of historical development, as if there could be an historical pathway we might take. What we're going to look at when we're together again as we pursue this journey is how history may work in this regard. Because the next philosopher we're going to consider is Hegel. And Hegel, who lived from 1770 to 1831, had a very strong sense of how Kant could be right about reason, the Romantics could be right about passion, but they could be brought together if we understood what the true development of history is.